Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Giles Brown.
Let's talk.
Serve. My lost years at the heart of Ireland's Opus Dei. Anne-Marie Allen was 15 when she was accepted onto a cookery school course that promised real qualifications and a future in the career of her dreams. What happened next was a quite horrendous tale that she's been brave enough to put down in a book called Serve. Anne-Marie Allen joins me live on the line now. Anne-Marie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles.
Good to have you with where do you join us from? You're based in Ireland at the moment. Where are you?
I'm based in County Leash in the Midlands in Ireland.
Nice part of the world indeed. So let's start off with the basics, because many of our listeners may not exactly be aware of what Opus Dei is. They may have heard of it, but they're not actually sure what exactly it entails. Can you give me, if you like, the Opus Dei 101 in your experience?
Opus Dei is a Catholic organization within the Catholic Church. I'm not here to promote Opus Dei. I would just give you the basic facts. founded by a priest called Father Escriva in Spain in 1928, and that's it. It has different grades of membership. And I was the lowest grade. I was called an assistant numerary. I was a servant grade at the very bottom, a lifelong celibate to do the domestic work in the residences of Opus Dei. That was, I was told, my vocation was.
So it is, because Opus Dei has obviously started in Spain. It was very, very, prominent. It's still obviously operative here in Spain and around the world during the 50s and 60s as Spain came modernized. So it is a group within the Catholic Church, if you like. That's the basics. Yeah. So your background then, you're born in rural Ireland. Tell me a little bit about the background.
I was actually born in the UK. I was born in London, reared in Basingstoke in Hampshire, and then when I was eight, I came to Ireland with my parents, and we settled in Kerry, and then we moved to Cork. So I was 15 when I first came in contact with Opus Dei. I wanted to be a chef. I wanted to cook. And to cut a long story short, two women came to the house one day through a mutual friend and interviewed me for this place in this college. Now, Ireland in 1978, in the 70s, was economically very poor. People were emigrating. They were going to the UK. They were going to America and so on. But we were guaranteed a job. This was the sweetener. I was told that I would get this job, and also that I would be paid £5 a week, which was pocket money. My parents thought that this was a good idea. They thought it was a great opportunity, and the job was huge. You know, when all of my peers in my class would have to possibly leave the country or be unemployed, you know, I was the one that had hit the jackpot. So my parents sent me there thinking that I was going to be very safe. I was going to not going to discos, not meeting boys, not getting into trouble. The television was locked behind a press with keys. And they thought it was going to be safe. But in fact, I was possibly walking into, I did walk into a very dangerous situation.
Because this is the thing, because this is the mid to late 70s. This is before all the scandals that break, if you will. It's a different island. It's a different Spain, because the church has a massive influence on daily life, more so than it does now in sort of 21st century Ireland. And so your parents and yourself must have been, this is wonderful news. This is the benefit, you know, the benediction of the church. I've got a job here. You know, nothing is going to interfere with my career path. So you must have been tremendously excited and a little bit apprehensive as a 15-year-old. As you sort of packed your suitcase and went off.
Yeah, I was. And, you know, I was an only daughter. I went to a boys' school. I had read all the Eden Blyton books, Mallory Towers and so on. And I was so excited going off, you know, going to this kind of boarding school with lots of other girls. And it was, you know, kind of, you know, fairy tale stuff. You know, so I was really looking forward to it and very excited for this huge change in my life, a positive change.
So the you originally started off, is it in Cork, is it in Dublin? Where is the first steps taken then?
I went to a place in the west of Ireland, a place called Ballyglunin House. It was a very historical house owned by the Blake family that Opus Dei had bought. It was a big conference centre, and there was a school in the stables at the back. The old house was turned into a conference centre, and the school was at the back, and, well, the so-called school. We right. went, there was no curriculum. There was no domestic science teachers when we went there. There was no, if you read the book, I went into a room one day and there was a pile of uniforms with grease stains on them. We were told, pick one, and that's going to be your uniform. And we basically started running Opus Dei centres.
So from the outside, I mean, if I had a time machine and I went back and as a gentleman in the 70s and was to go to this conference centre, would I think that anything was slightly, shall we say, untoward was going on? Did it seem like a legitimate business from the front? Because the way you describe it, you know, the school, quote unquote, is at the back, but presumably they're functioning in every day. The facade, presumably, they present to the outside world is somewhat different to what your experience is happening.
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's what Opus Dei is very good at. It's presenting the facade, you know, what they want you to think is going on. But in the back, behind the scenes, you know, what's going on is not correct, in my opinion, my experience. It's, I was 15 years of age. I started to work in a university residence for men and boys in Galway. We were bussed into this house, went in the back gate, down into a basement, and we cooked and cleaned and did laundry there from 8:30 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night and bussed back. No pay, no time off. I was 15 and I wasn't the youngest.
I was going to say, so are you, I mean, do you come, well, you obviously go to this place on your own. Is there an intake of young girls at the same time? Are there ones just arriving? I mean, is there a term structure if it's supposed to be a course?
There was a term structure. There was, I think, maybe 8 or 10 of us that started. By Christmas, that had gone down to 5. And I think of that, it was a 2-year course. It followed a term time, basically, but we didn't have any summer holidays. We didn't have any Easter holidays. Well, a couple of days off. By the time we finished, there was 3 of us. And two of us had joined Opus Dei.
Obviously, I mean, it's very easy to say, oh, well, why didn't you just leave? But again, you're 15 years old. It's the 70s. You come from rural Ireland. Your parents are very proud about this. It's, you know, it's Opus Dei, it's the Catholic Church. It's fantastic. Did you mentioned that obviously the numbers decreased. Did these girls run away? Did they write to their parents? And presumably you were put under pressure that if you, you know, psychologically, if you leave, then that is your life over. And you're almost sort of rejecting the church if you leave, sort of thing, Anne-Marie, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose my book will outline it. You know, I went there as a student, but I was targeted more or less straight away to become a member.
Right.
You know, they start to introduce. Oh, my parents left. They dropped me off at the gate, said goodbye. They left, and immediately they started introducing us to Opus Dei and telling us about the founder and what they did. We were kind of given a tutor then to help us with our so-called studies. There was no studies. But what we were doing, they befriended us, started telling them our teenage issues, and I did anyway. And next thing they say, if you pray, things will get better if you do this. And next thing, the idea of a vocation to Opus Dei was gradually introduced. And you were told, we all see it, that you have a vocation as big as a house, it was the term. And you're kind of thinking there was something wrong with you that but you were told you were beautiful, you were funny, you were such a hard worker and all that. And then it kind of then turned sinister after a while in that if you kind of were rejecting what they were saying, they'd say, look, bad things will happen to you if you don't join or if you don't follow your vocation, and bad things will happen to your family. And I was 15. Now, I was vulnerable. Mm. I was very naive. I was very innocent. And I saw these women who were very well dressed. They were very articulate. They were intelligent. They had qualifications. And they seemed very happy. So they must be right. And I must be, there's something wrong with me that I don't see it. So you're brought into this. And next thing one day, a priest came to the center and said, you know, I hear you're thinking of joining Opus Dei. And would you think about joining as an assistant numerary? And I kind of said, it was all very quick. It was all very, very, very steady, very, very well thought out, but very quick. So only a few months after I went there, I signed my life away and became an assistant numerary, a.k.a. a servant in their organization as a lifelong celibate to clean, do the domestic work in their centers of Opus Dei, and basically lead a very, difficult and hard life. Yeah.
Because I'm thinking, because they've got these, you know, I know a little about this because of some bits and pieces, and they've got these, this sort of top layer where they're all well dressed, you know, the women look absolutely wonderful, the guys, you know, that they're successful business people. But I don't know the structure, Anne-Marie. So if you could indulge me. So right. Is the possibility then that you can rise through the order and therefore, or is it almost feudal and hierarchical? You will serve. And by serving the hierarchy, therefore you are serving God, etc.
Yeah, 100%. So, there is a very strict hierarchical structure, as you said, feudal, and it's a great word, actually. So there's obviously, there's the numeraries that run the Opus Dei centres, they run Opus Dei, there's two separate sections, the male and the female section. And then there's the numeraries, and then there's supernumeraries, they're the married members. They obviously live with their families and they come in for their spiritual formation. And then there's the assistant numeraries who were us. And there was no upward mobility. There was no class changing. That was your life. And that is what they told you God had planned for you. You have a vocation in that. So the others could change under very strict circumstances. But an assistant numerary, once an assistant numerary, always an assistant numerary.
And you've taken, you said, a vow of celibacy as well. Was that correct? Yeah. So at the age of 15, you've basically said, and I mean, poverty is going to go hand in hand with that one as well, obviously, because of the work you're doing. I mean, that's if you were to take your vows, there would be a period of introspection. You would be counseled, and that's the 21st century. But you see where I'm going here. But as a 15-year-old adolescent, they're saying that door is shut. You are part till, you know, basically to the end of your life.
Yeah, and just to clarify, I was 16 when I actually joined.
Wow. You know, so still, I mean, yeah.
Get the facts right. And we were, you know, there was no choice.
Yeah.
There was no freedom of thought. You know, they talk about Dr. Steve Hassan. He has the BITE model, you know, and he talks about behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotional control. You know, that was just imposed on us at every turn. There was no time to breathe. So, you know, discernment and choice and all that weren't there. You know, an Opus Dei would tell you, oh, you're free to do whatever. There was no freedom in our thoughts, in our emotions. Everything was explored, examined, judged, criticized. You know, every moment of our day was filled up from the moment we woke up until we went to bed. You know, so it was, and there was no upward mobility. You know, I didn't even have the freedom to go and throw my legs up on the sofa and watch a bit of TV, have a cup of tea. Couldn't do that. Our books, our post was read, our phone calls were listened to, our wardrobe was decided, our food was decided, everything. Who we spoke to and why we spoke to them, all of that monitored, micromanaged, etc.
And of course, your world has shrunk to basically the centre because there's no outside influence, because you know the TV's under lock and key. You're not going down as a 16-year-old might do, you know, go down to the local, you know, the village or whatever, the nearest place and meet people. Your entire life is there. And as I said, the post is read. You know, your parents, presumably, you want to put out a good, so your parents don't worry, you want to put a good image to your parents when you're first there. You want to say, this, you don't want to be seen as a quitter, perhaps. But maybe that was one of the things as well.
Well, absolutely. And to leave the course, you know, would have been a big blow, really, because the promises had been so big. But they didn't know I was in Opus Dei until I think I was in Opus Dei a year and 3 months before I actually informed them that I had joined, because I was told not to tell them. They wouldn't understand. And I was well and truly entrenched in their thought process and in their in what they did. At that point, I was gone too far. I couldn't back out then.
You end up in Rome.
And I was afraid to back out because I was told I'd go to hell and I'd bring my family with me and that bad things would happen to me. So I was terrified.
And you end up in Rome. You're taken from Ireland to Rome. Am I correct? You get taken to Italy. I mean, tell us about. I mean, did you have any choice in the matter? Is my next question.
Well, I was still technically I was still a student at that point, and that is where I joined Opus Dei.
Right.
And they have a conference every year. Opus Dei has a conference in Rome in around Easter time called the Univ Conference, and students and all that go there. So it was, and Pope John Paul II had just been elected. It was his first Easter, and there was an excitement around, you know, and I was kind of caught up in that. But I was, you know, it was very much maneuvered how I would join. There was a lot of people involved in it. A very sophisticated recruitment plan was put into action, and I joined Opus Dei, and they boasted afterwards that I was so easy to recruit.
And whereabouts are you based? Are you based in the Vatican itself? Is there an Opus Dei built? All right, so explain to me the geography then, if you can, because I'm trying to get my head around it.
Opus Dei has the headquarters of Opus Dei is in Rome. I can't remember the area of it, but they have a good few centres in Rome.
Yeah.
And that's where the headquarters are, and that's where the founder is buried and so on, yeah.
And so you're in Rome. Presumably, you're having some. Did you learn Italian? Do you know what's going on? Is it in English? Is it in Latin? I mean, what's your day to day there? Are you now, you know, are you now serving, literally, sort of cleaning up and doing laundry for you know, people in a different language almost, and with people that you haven't sort of met? Explain the day to day drudgery of that one.
Okay, well, we just went for a conference, Giles, and it was a 10-day conference, and it was very intense. What we did, I mean, the whole purpose of that conference is to recruit young people. You know, that's what the purpose of that conference is. And if they say otherwise, it's not. That's what it's there for. So I was there with just a bunch of other people, and we did, you know, we did the tour, but it was all very much focused on Opus Dei. Mm. I was just there for 10 days, and I came back then a fully fledged member of Opus Dei at the age of 16.
And so you go back to Ireland, and you're back to the centre in Ireland at that point then, yeah?
Yeah, back to the centre in Ireland, and I then became a full member of Opus Dei at the age of 16. My parents didn't know. I was separated from what was left of the students, and I Yeah, it was just very, very difficult time, yeah.
What's the accommodation like? Well, I mean, do you have your own quarters? Are you bunking up? Are there dormitories? You know, can you put a lock on your door, for example? I've got goddaughters. Yeah, I live with my goddaughters. And locks on the door are a big thing because people keep stealing each other's clothes. But, you know, every teen needs their privacy. Can you escape? Can you put a lock on your door?
No. I didn't have a handbag. I didn't have a purse. I didn't have a key. I had no money. I had to ask permission for absolutely everything. So the accommodation was inferior accommodation. We slept in kind of, you never sleep in rooms, either 1, 3 or 5. You never slept in pairs because they were afraid of whatever sexual activity or like really paranoid about that kind of thing, temptation and all the rest of it. So there was always an odd number in a bedroom, but it was very basic accommodation. The assistant numeraries wore secondhand clothes, ate the leftovers if they were there. And, you know, we addressed these ladies as miss. You know, we have secondhand cutlery, lower class, everything was low grade. And keep in mind, we were not paid. We received no pay, no sick leave, no money.
Yeah.
You know,
it's servitude basically. You're basically, you know, at the lowest rung. You say they were paranoid about sort of sexual things happening, but there's presumably psychological and even physical abuse going on, because a lot of it is you are at this level, and you know, pain and suffering is part of the great plan of the universe, if you like.
Yeah. You've heard about the mortification that, you know, of the, using the chain and the whip, Giles, you know.
Explain for those who haven't heard about mortification, because a lot of us, you know, wouldn't know about that.
Okay, so flagellation, we had a whip that we were given on a Saturday, and we had to whip ourselves on a Saturday to a prayer on our bum and our back and our legs, and then that we wore a chain with inverted barbs on it, and you had to wear that on your leg for 2 hours, and sometimes that was increased, and that was to keep our desires in check, keep them in control. We had cold showers. We slept on the floor a night a week without a pillow a night a week. And you know, somebody might say having a cold shower, that's actually quite it gets the blood going. But when you're doing that on a constant basis every single day, you're physically abusing your body. It was organisationally approved self harm.
The mortification, is that for all members of Opus Dei, or is it just for your level? Or are all members of, as far as we were aware, had to do the mortification? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of that high strata again, you see. I can't see these well-dressed men and women doing the mortification.
Now, this was numeraries and assistant numeraries did this. And the priests as well, everyone did it, yeah. And keep in mind that in Vatican Council II, Giles, this was more or less banned, this type of mortification. That's a lot of what I've been getting on social media, is that, Asher, you know, saints did that and blah, but it was actually outlawed. Or banned and disapproved of in Vatican Council too. But I was 16, I was given a chain and a whip, and I was told, you're to do this. There was no consent given. I wasn't asked for my consent. I was told, you report back and tell us when you have it done.
When did your sort of family start to, did they start to sort of get warning signs? And again, thankfully, we live in a culture now where people are aware of, I mean, say what people say, we're all gone woke, but thankfully, the majority of times we are able to spot when somebody is being abused, when somebody's being groomed, because that is basically almost trafficked in your case. You've definitely groomed in modern parlance. So when did people start, you know, outside? When did your parent, your family, for example, start to sort of look quizzically?
I'd say my family thought that I was thought that I'd grow out of it, you know. But then when I wasn't coming home to see them, when I did go home to see them, I had two people with me. I remember my mother saying that my letters didn't seem normal. It was hard to get me on the phone and so on. But then in 1981, Cardinal Basil Hume in the UK issued a directive, and he said that Opus Dei were not to recruit children under 14 years of age. And they agreed. externally, but internally they were going mad. I was there. But my family, I had family in the UK, and they sent my parents home the document or, you know, any information they had from the newspapers. And there was a program, I think, a BBC program done on it. And they, I remember they sent the script of the program to my parents, and my parents, especially my dad, he got very, very concerned. So he tried a long negotiation to get me home just for a visit. And there was bishops involved. There was, there was a standoff between my father and Opus Dei for about 2 years. And eventually he got me home. And when I did get home, he said, "You're not going back." And it's in the book, you know, it's a huge thing. I wasn't aware what was going on, because I wasn't really informed by either side, and I was kind of caught in the middle at that stage. I was 21 years of age.
When you sort of walked away that time, because you said you normally left with two people, presumably they were very outgoing, smooth, we would call them sort of spin doctors now. They weren't going to be, you know, with blood dripping down their legs from the mortification, etc. Presumably they were the happy human face of Opus Dei, or, you know, the respectable face of Opus Dei. But if when you were leaving, presumably, did anybody say, well, if you do leave, you know, that is damnation for you, your family, you know, you're going back to the secular world, nothing good happens out there?
Oh, 100%. That was what I was saying. That was drummed into me. And I genuinely believed that that would happen, Giles. I'll be honest with you. I fully believed everything that they said to me. But deep down, I was beginning to question it. The cracks were beginning to form. A number of things happened. I was beginning to get quite ill. I wasn't being cared for. I wasn't being looked at. I didn't see the people around me being cared for. Everybody was under huge pressure. I could see people breaking down in front of me. And then you get up one morning and they'd be gone. So, you know, things, the cracks were beginning to appear for me. So I went home, and I was 21 years of age, but I had the perception of a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, and I still believed everything that they had that they said. So the Opus Dei members left, but I was still a member of Opus Dei and I was living in the world. I had a huge time. I had huge issues trying to adjust to the outside world. It was unbelievable.
No, because,
you know, but but Opus Dei continued to pursue me, even though my parents were quite clear, you are not to ever set foot in this place again. But they pursued me long and hard for about a year and 3 months. Yeah. And eventually I got to leave.
Because, I mean, in modern parlance, you've been radicalised. Simple as that. I mean, you've been radicalised. Simple. And you don't just suddenly go home, push a button, and it's all back to where you were 14 years old. It's going to take you years to get over what you've been through, the trauma.
Yeah. Sorry, could you just say that again?
I mean, if that happened today, if you had been picked up from another cult, for example, they said you had been radicalised because you had been taken as a teen. And when you go back into the world, it's not a question of then you just open a door and everything is, you know, flowers and the sun comes up and you skip down the path. It's going to take you years to get over that.
Yeah, and it did take a long, long time for me. And in many ways, I'm still discovering things and healing from those. But I suffered really badly with my health. I suffered from depression. You know, there was a few plans to, you know, end it all on a couple of occasions. I definitely suffered from PTSD. You know, I wasn't able to handle the world. I wasn't able to handle relationships. I think during the darkest times within Opus Dei and beyond it, there was always a little glimmer of hope that things would improve. And it took about 20 years. I was in Opus Dei. My whole contact with Opus Dei was for about 7 years. They say for every 7 years of trauma, it takes 3 times that in order to get to the other side. And it took me about 20, 21 years to wake up one day and say, you know, I'm okay. I'm okay now. But I went through some very, very dark times, made some very poor decisions, and learned from them. A lot of pain. All done by Opus Dei.
The book, As you can tell, I could probably talk to you until Saturday week about this, but I'm going to unfortunately run out of time. The book is called Serve, My Lost Years at the Heart of Ireland's Opus Dei. It's by Anne Murray Allen, who we're speaking to today. Listeners, you can go to our virtual bookstore, click on the front cover and the book, and order the book that way as well. Do you do, I mean, it might be a facile question, are you, can people find you online? Is there some way they can follow you, or which way can, how can they find out more about you and your inspiring story?
Okay. Well, I just want to say one final line. This isn't just my story. It's the story of thousands. There's thousands of us all over the world that are ex-members of Opus Dei that have suffered trauma from our experiences of all grades. So I just want to say that. So you can find me on LinkedIn, Anne Marie Allen. I'd be delighted to talk to anyone that wants to contact me. I really appreciate that you're highlighting this subject, Giles. I really appreciate it, because it's a story that needs to be told for thousands of us. I mean, all right, and thank you for doing that.
The pleasure. It's not even a pleasure. It's been an absolute inspiration to speak to you. The book is called Serve. Go and order it. By Anne Murray Allen. Anne Murray, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.